order. The date today is March 23rd. Members in attendance are Representative Davidson, Cotton, Herman, Navarre, and Hoffman. Today we'll be taking up a resolution and a bill, HDR 64, which is relating to Alaska participation in the bottom fisheries and other benefits from the exclusive economic zone of the United States off the coast of Alaska. And House Bill 490, which is safety standards for commercial fishing vessels. At this time, I'll just talk briefly about HDR 64. And first I'd like to make brief remarks about the exclusive economic zone. On March 10, 1983, President Reagan established by proclamation an exclusive economic zone for the United States and thereby joined 58 other coastal nations, declaring jurisdiction over the ocean resources adjacent to their land masses. The coastal states have a strong interest in the protection, conservation, and development of the coastal and ocean resources bordering their shoreline, since they are closest to both the problems and opportunities involving their use. The rational management of ocean resources is a difficult matter for two fundamental reasons: our present complex system of ocean governmental jurisdiction and the nature of the ocean itself. The challenge, therefore, is to design and implement an equitable and efficient ocean resource management system in the face of the nation's jurisdictional complexities and the ocean's complex nature. Our United States exclusive economic zone extends 200 miles off the coast. I believe we do not know all the powers we as a state have over the EEZ. Let me now explain the reason I introduced this bill. I found that many of our fisheries in the state benefit other states as well. Our fisheries and decision-making bodies for those fisheries are many times controlled by outside interests. I would like to see this stop. Many times the capitalization of a fishery is done by outside interests because they either have existing equipment or capital to invest in the needed equipment. There is so much effort out there now in the bottom fishery that people are worried about the resource. Therefore, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council is looking at, quote, limiting entry into that fishery. And it always seems that fisheries are becoming limited before Alaskans even get a chance to be involved in the fishery. You know, I would like to see Alaskans involved, and I know that there are ways to get them involved, but we cannot do this if our fisheries are limited. And I would like to have further discussion on the bill if anybody has any comments or questions. Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Lines 22 through 24 resolve that the Alaska State legislation.
On page 2?
Page 2, I'm sorry, yes. It addresses the entry into the bottom fisheries and speaks about no less than 50% by participation by Alaskans. And my concern here is that such a resolve flies in the face of the Magnuson Act, and I was just wondering how this would be viewed in Washington, because I know that there cannot be favoritism shown toward any geographic area. So I was wondering if this is maybe something that we should have a little more discussion on.
What takes precedence, the FCZMA or the EEZ? You know, I'm just saying that there's a lot of questions, and if we, you know, why not say this? Say we're concerned, let's do it. And if they can't do it, then they'll probably write us a letter saying, I'm sorry, but we can't do this, and then quote, you know, quote either the Management Act or maybe there's something in the EEZ that says, yes, you have, the states have the right to do this. And, you know, I think further on it says something about, you know, a partnership too somewhere. Yeah. Further resolved on 25, Alaska State Legislature, the state of Alaska should enter into partnership with the United States for the management of activities, especially fisheries in the EEZ.
Well,
I'm just saying, why not try? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I agree. I guess there's nothing wrong with trying. In fact, I think that's one of the areas where we've got to get at the table to help set the agenda of what's going to happen in EEZ. And so I see this resolution as another signal to say we need to get involved in ocean resource management in the EEZ. such as California, Washington, and Oregon have already passed legislation that gets them more involved at the table as far as setting the agenda as to what the federal government will be doing in setting policies and regulations governing the EEC. So, but I just wanted to bring that point up because oftentimes if they, it seems that there's something red flag before we get an opportunity to really make our point, it has less impact.
Are there any further questions or reports on that?
I just wanted to know what you had in mind here. What particular fisheries were you thinking about when you say that many Alaskans have not had the opportunity to participate in those fisheries? I agree that the larger boats that are required to harvest some of the bottom fish probably haven't allowed a lot of Alaskans that opportunity, but depends on what you mean when you say bottom fish. You're talking about halibut, then I don't think that statement would be as accurate. And so therefore I'm just asking, are you talking about mostly pollock and sailfish?
The ones that, you know, they're talking about limiting sablefish, and they're also talking about, you know, other ground fish in the Bering Sea and I guess elsewhere.
So I know that limited entry for any species is an extremely controversial subject, and when I first started reading through this resolution, I thought you might be preparing to make a statement about limited entry, but what you've resolved here is something that I can easily support, suggesting that people who live in Alaska should have as good an opportunity as possible to participate in those fisheries.
I believe there's a resolution against limiting entry and sablefish on the Senate side.
Just have a question.
Yeah. Representative Davidson.
Thank you. In the matter of limited entry and the benefit going to places like Seattle, when Senator Stevens was here, I did ask that question on the floor, and I'm not sure if he answered my question, but he indicated that the answer to the problem of getting Alaskans involved in our bottom fisheries industry is a matter of money, because our banks apparently are not willing to come forth with the financing to get Alaskans involved in that. So I don't know, perhaps we should be thinking of somewhere where we can put some whereas that addresses the financial matter. It's a thought. I certainly support the resolution as written. I just want to make sure that it isn't red flagged, and I want to make sure that it does, in fact, get the people back in Washington realizing that a great deal of the EEZ that was proclaimed by the President's proclamation is, in fact, in a large percentage right here in Alaska. And it's an area that's going to be very important to Alaska as well as the nation. And I, for one, think that Alaskans should be the first to benefit from it.
Check out page 2, lines 1 through 5, and see if that takes care of it. 1 through 5.
Mm-hmm. I think it does suggest it in part, but
because I don't think Alaskans are going to get involved by you know, getting the capital and getting in there. I think they're going to get involved by being a crew member. You know, I think in the beginning, and there are a few people that are gearing up, but very few Alaskans. You know, maybe it'll come down to the share quota, which would be best for the crew members, and wait till Alaskans can get in. Any further comments? Anybody? Anybody else to testify? I'd entertain a motion to move.
So moved, Madam Chair. Okay.
Any objections to moving HJR 64 to our committee? Hearing none, so moved. I'll pick up possible 498. Prime sponsor, Representative Davidson. I have a few concerns about the bill, and I'll pose those questions to you after.
Okay.
You're through.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Jim Miller was a friend of mine, and last weekend when I was home, I learned that yet another vote went down in Kodiak. My friend had three children, and he and his wife were expecting a fourth. And this is the primary reason that I've introduced House Bill 490. It's an unusual bill because it originates from Kodiak fishermen, fishermen who are willing to regulate themselves and their industry for the benefit of the safety to all. As sad as it is to say, Madam Chairman, the commercial fishing industry has a losing track record when it comes to safety. The natural elements in fishing can easily overwhelm boat and crew. In Kodiak alone, we lost 10 fishermen in the last 3 months, and some of the deaths could have been prevented had the boats been equipped with the proper safety equipment. In 1986, 62 lives were lost in boating accidents in Alaska before the Coast Guard responded to those accidents, and 23 were lost after the Coast Guard response. To their credit, the Coast Guard saved 262 lives, but of the 85 who perished, I wonder how many deaths could have been prevented by House Bill 490. House Bill 490 would require that all fishing vessels 32 feet and longer be equipped with an exposure suit or survival suit for everyone on board. Would also require an EPIRB. An EPIRB, as you know, is an emergency positioning indicator radio beacon, and a life raft. Many fishing vessels already have this safety equipment, but many do not. House Bill 490 requires that the safety equipment be in good working condition. That's the maintenance clause of the legislation, and gives the power of enforcement to the Department of Fishing Game and Public Safety to ensure that these items are aboard. House Bill 490 also establishes a safety advisory council for fishing vessels, which would suggest, review, and recommend legislation, regulations, and guidelines concerning vessel safety. The council would also consider and review proposals relating to the development and implementation of educational programs to increase the awareness among participants and potential participants in the commercial fishing industry. The council shall also consider guidelines and requirements relating to maintenance, servicing, and upgrading of safety and life-saving equipment, and recommend a permanent method for the state to evaluate current and future needs relating to legislation, regulations, and guidelines for commercial fishing vessel safety. There is a small fiscal note submitted with this legislation. The committee, or the council rather, is the reason for this fiscal note. However, the $27,000 is not necessarily the amount that it would require. We are also working with the university and the Sea Grant program to perhaps fund an interim or a three-year safety council advisory board. So I think that even the minimal fiscal note submitted can be substantially reduced if in fact we can get a Sea Grant to establish this safety council. I would also like to draw attention of the committee to the enclosed in your packet is a newspaper article from the Kodiak Daily Mirror, And I hope that each of you would take the opportunity to read that article, because I think it establishes very well the need for such a program as House Bill 490 requests. There, in that article, Tom Walters, an officer in the U.S. Coast Guard who has flown many search and rescue missions, establishes a four-part approach to safety or survival on the sea. He indicates in the article there that it's education, exposure suit, life raft, and EPIRBS. And you can read about his record as far as rescuing people for yourself. But he indicated that anyone who's had all four of these three items on board, as well as having been educated about safety, he's never picked up a person who died because of that. But many people that he had picked up had one or two of these things. So safety is serious business, and it's something that we must practice. It's something that we must apparently enforce, because people are not going ahead on their own, although many do. There's still entirely too much loss of life. And in closing, Madam Chairman, I would simply say that the cost of doing business should include the cost of saving lives, saving families, by saving moms and dads who happen to be commercial fishermen. And that's my statement.
Very good. I agree with a lot of what you said. I do have a few concerns. I think number one is, you know, when we start to legislate things like safety, you know, with the, we had the helmet law before us. I think we had a helmet law once, didn't we? Yeah, and we don't anymore. We used, we had a legislator here from the Matsu area that wanted to legislate like three-wheeler safety, and that was a big concern in rural Alaska. You know, they've outlawed three-wheelers since then, but you know, this legislation, they wanted special gloves, certain kind of lights on the three-wheeler, and license plates and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, I have some concern there about, you know, legislating safety. And then you touched on the concern about the cost of another group, and I like the idea of the University Sea Grant Program, because I was going to suggest, can existing groups like the Marine Advisory Program, you know, can they put together the program, because they do a lot of that now anyway. And then letting the fishermen know about this is the other thing I think that we have to, you know, look at through the committee process. You know, the cost, then, like you pointed out, what's the cost of your life? And then, like, the room for the rafts, you know, on a 32-foot boat, there's, you just hoard all the room you can get, you know. So, I don't know, I'm just wondering about that. Then, like, the idea of the educational programs in the school, and maybe that could be part of the fisheries program thing that, that I'm pushing. So, I agree with the concept, and I think we can, you know, work on this. And then I'd like to let fishermen know, too, about what's going on. Rips in the con.
I'd yield if Mr. Davidson.
No,
I guess my concern was, and I pointed out to you earlier, that my example is I've got a 24-foot jitney, and I'm fishing primarily shallow water. It's an open boat. There's a crew of three, plus the man in the skiff. It just seems to me that it'd be impractical for us to carry survival suits. Now, if we were out in the open ocean with that small boat, we'd be crazy to begin with, but we should certainly ought to have survival suits if we did it. So even if we had them, it'd be impractical. Usually when you jump off the side of the boat, you land about knee-deep water or in the mud, so. But there are other times when you're in water over your head, certainly, so just it isn't going to be an expense that I want to go to, so, because I don't think I need it. But a larger boat that spends time out in the inlet, for instance, they certainly ought to all have survival suits, and I'd be inclined to support you on that. The other question I had was on, so now the way I read it here, it says any boat that is subject to this chapter must be equipped with a suit, and so you defined this chapter applies to vessels required to be licensed under 1605-490. and I look at 490, and it says that as a condition to delivery or landing a fish or engaging in commercial fishing, it like this is required. So that means everybody that has a boat that lands or delivers fish has to have a license. But it isn't limited to.
The intent here is this creates a new chapter 35.
Right.
And by doing it that way, I think that your 24-foot vessel would be exempt from this legislation.
That's not the way I read it, but if that's the intent, that's fine.
That is the intent.
Then the other question, as I look at 490 here, I see, you know, my boat there, but so there's an exemption for salmon fishing boats between the latitudes of Point Romanoff and the latitude of Point Newenham and state water surrounding Nunavak Island. I was curious about that, but maybe somebody could point out on the map where Romanoff and Newenham are. Do you know right offhand? Maybe the people from public safety know exactly where those two points are.
Pardon?
Point Romanoff and Cape Newenham.
In the Crystal Bay. Crystal Bay upwards, yeah.
Okay, where's Romanoff?
Romanoff, I believe, is west of there, but I'm not sure.
It's up further.
So it includes the state water surrounding Nunavak, so maybe north of that. So that area right now is exempt from the provision of 490, so it appears that they would be exempt from the bill as well.
We've made an effort, excuse me, we've made an effort to understand the situation for people like yourself and the impact it would have on Bristol Bay. We are primarily interested in getting safety equipment aboard, or required safety equipment aboard these vessels that go out into the open sea and which are 32 feet or longer, or if necessary, perhaps we would have to attach some tonnage language. But the thing I think that's important to remember is that this came from the fishing industry itself. Fishermen are trying to do something about the loss of life that we have experienced in Kodiak, and as I mentioned before, that's we've had the loss of 10 people within the last 3 months, and I think clearly something has to be done, and I certainly don't want to impose any more rules or regulations, more than any other person here, but I think that if you were in my situation where there has been a tremendous loss of life and the sorrow and the manner in which it affects your community, I think the time to act has come, and that's why I agree with this legislation. And it seems a strange thing that we would have to require people to by law to have safety equipment, but the numbers are there, and I think it is time to act.
That's just real.
Sure.
I can ask later. I deal.
Well, you know, I guess I support what you're trying to do here as well, Representative Davidson, but I have one fishery in my district that is a river fishery on the Kuskokwim, and Representatives Wallace and Springer have fishery on the Yukon, and I'm not aware, at least on the Kuskokwim, of anyone having drowned while they were commercial fishing. And they do utilize boats larger than 24 feet. So I guess I'm concerned about the requirement that those people would have to have survival suits. The fishery isn't a lucrative fishery. In many instances, the fishermen make less than $15,000 a year, and they do utilize their boats not only for fishing, but for major use in transportation along the coast. So unless those people are exempted, I think that I won't be able to support the legislation. Hopefully we can make sure that those people on rivers that are fishing are exempt somehow.
Madam Chairman, I have no problem making an exemption for inland water type situations or the situation which Representative Hoffman has addressed. Perhaps public safety could better address and has a better understanding of you know, how that could be done. Again, I emphasize that we're talking about people who go out into the open situation, and so I don't know, the boats that you're talking about, are they longer than 32 feet?
No.
So they would be exempt under the intent of this legislation anyway.
I was under the impression you said 24 feet.
No, that was the length of Representative Cotton's boat, and this bill says here 32 feet.
How big are those rafts that you went on? I mean, how compact would they be?
Well, I understand they're about the size of a bed and mattress. So.
Oh, okay.
Big enough to carry everybody on board, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't have any problem with requiring one or the other for open water in Cook Inlet. I fished one time with a guy who didn't have survival suits, and I appealed to the guy who owned the boat. He bought some for us. The other guy I fished with has them on board, but we just don't have it. I think I fished on a 34-foot boat this year, and we just didn't have any room for a raft in order to make it an efficient working space, but we did have survival suits. And, I mean, I think it makes good common sense if you're out in the middle of Cook Inlet, even in certainly more open water, to have the survival equipment, but I don't know that we need both. And my last comment is that education is far more important, I think, than a requirement for the safety equipment, or as important to do it.
Well, you know, someone mentioned some of the requirements we're making on people who drive automobiles, for example. And certainly, it's important. It is a right. It's not, you know. It's a privilege rather than a right to drive a car down our road, and I see this becoming a similar kind of situation. If you're responsible for other people's lives as a boat owner or a skipper, then I think it's important that you give the human safety factor due consideration, and if we can't do it through voluntary effort, then that's when the state generally is forced to take the kinds of action that is suggested by 490. Mm-hmm. And so I can sympathize, and I'm willing to work with the requirement of a life raft or any other thing, but I think we need something, a very minimal type of requirement that says this will be done, because otherwise people get relaxed and slack in their attempts to affect other people's lives, and this is why, again, I offer this legislation.
Yeah. I think that this legislation is a good start. You know, there's concerns in the Bristol Bay area too. They call Ugashik the combat zone. You know, where they're down there, and it's so competitive now that, you know, they're on the lines, fishing right on the lines, and people are ramming people. They're, you know, running over people's nets, and then you know, we found that when somebody tries to you know, get some kind of action for that, you know, in court or whatever, that it's very hard to do. And in fact, you know, maybe we could have public safety talk about that, because there's really no, you know, if you're rammed out there, you really have no recourse to get that other person. It's just It's held up. I don't know any cases, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, that have, you know, been resolved like this out there. And, you know, that's a safety question, too. Representative Hoffman.
I have a question. Does engaged in commercial fishing in state waters include the tenders?
I have not had that conversation, but I think that I would think yes. I mean, we're still talking about human lives, and if there's human lives aboard vessels that are over 32 feet, then they should certainly fall under the legislation.
Then I have the same problem, I guess, about tenders requiring these safety suits within inland waters. Because I don't think that, you know, they're that critical in inland waters. The larger the boat is in, you know, in the Kuskokwim on the Yukon, there's a less likelihood that an accident's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, so are you saying then that the tenders up in your area are less than 32 feet?
No.
But even if it were 32 feet or longer, you still don't think that the state should require the tender to have any safety equipment aboard?
No, I don't think it would be necessary for them to have survival suits. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they could have the other, you know, the rafts or lifeboats.
How, if I may, so how would the individuals, if they were, say, following it, if they, someone, well, I don't know.
Step off a boat, and somebody on board would put out the life raft, or
it seems
use a personal flotation device, and they'd get back on board, or they'd go to shore, because the river isn't that large.
Well, I don't,
it's not like you're 5 miles away from land when you're fishing within a river, or even tendering on off a boat on the Kuskokwim or on the Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
You have two banks to go to.
Well, if you're talking right within the mouth of the water or inside the river, then I can understand. But if you're out, say, a half a mile, and I'm not familiar with the situation which you speak, but I don't see what the problem would be to help save lives there.
Well, I'm concerned about lives too, but the fisheries on the Kuskokwim and the Yukon start from the bay, and then they go all the way up the river.
Mm-hmm.
You know, several miles both on the Kuskokwim and on the Yukon, and for them, because they're fishing there, to be required. You know, the tender may have 12 people on board, and to have him be required to purchase survival suits when, in all practicality, they're not going to use those. If they fall off the boat, they can use their personal flotation device and get to shore, or they can, the people that are on board can use the life rafts to go get them. They're not going to be, what I'm saying is, you know, the need for a survival suit is that you're going to be in water for an extended period of time. If you're going to be fishing or if you're going to be tendering on inland waters, you're not going to be in the water for an extended period of time.
Well, I have no problem with, adjusting the legislation so that it meets your concerns. My primary emphasis is to, where there is the chance of a marine accident or mishap, I simply want to protect the human beings in that situation. If you think that, I don't know how long people can be in the water up where you are, but I know down around Kodiak, 2 or 3 minutes and you're a goner. And
the way to have a lot of this discussion in subcommittee, I'm going to put the bill in subcommittee. I'd like to also get to the witness here soon, Representative Cotton.
Yeah, I just, on the question about whether tenders would be included, 490 says, as a condition to delivery or landing of fish. So I'm not sure if that means a tender, if you're saying that landing of fish is there, therefore would apply. And at some point, I'd like to get some recent information on the average cost of a survival suit.
It's approximately $275, I think.
$275. What about the per?
I think that's about $140.
And then I guess you can guess at life rafts, but if you're thinking about...
Well, EPIRBs can cost from $170 to $400, life rafts from $700 to $1,000. The thing is, if I may, recently in Kodiak, we had the we had a test of different e-perps. I think they set off, I don't know, 6 to 12, and none of them worked. So that was further example of why, you know, we need a multi-pronged approach to what kind of safety equipment should be required. You know, if, you're going to hang your life on a simple exposure suit, and there's different kinds of things to consider in exposure suit, you know, what's the fitting? And the educational program, I think, is imperative that we get people to start thinking about surviving before it happens. Just as in the article I suggest that you read it, he says, very first sentence, survival is a matter of staying alive. You do or you don't. And I just hope that we, as a committee, a subcommittee effort, can work quickly to ensure that we do. And so I'm willing to work with you for all of your concerns and try to iron out, you know, the different difficulties of whether it's too costly for a specific kind of operation or whatever. But I think that it is long overdue to have some kind of safety equipment aboard vessels when innocent people come aboard and are part of a commercial effort. We expect that kind of coverage in factory situations, and we have certain safety regulations that we require people driving cars to follow. And I, you know, as much as I hate to say, well, it's time to put some more rules out there on the sea, I'm into the business of saving lives, and that's why I'm sponsoring this legislation.
Okay, did you have some cost figures on the life rafts that you described here? Say for a four-person life raft that meets the standards that are set out. If not, we can get that later. I don't know.
Like I say, the life rafts cost from $700 to $1,000, and maybe that's how we can get our applied science people to work on something that would be adequate. Would be much cheaper, you know. There's sure that there's going to be a lot of technological evolution in what's available for saving lives in the ocean.
What's the penalty then, the misdemeanor class B? What's the penalty?
90 days. $1,000.
Well, let me give you an example of something that happened. You know, a boat that recently went down, they'd spent a lot of money revamping the boat. They spent a lot of money in making, you know, they had all kinds of fancy equipment and so they didn't go the extra $2,000 or $3,000 for a life raft and proper survival suits and an e-perb. One e-perb was they had it, but it wasn't the kind that a class A, so it didn't happen. If that boat had an e-perb, and all the people that came off of that vessel did in fact have exposure suits on, I think we lost about 4 people in that accident. Because they thought, well, geez, it's not going to happen to us. Heck, we just rebuilt this boat, put a lot of money into it, so we'll take a chance. And that is a tragedy that continues today.
Finally, the last question I had on that B misdemeanor thing, it seems like there might be another way to approach that, too, to say that they get their license, you ain't can tell they can fly. Mm-hmm. It might be a little better than threatening somebody with jail time, but that's just a thought. Don't need to dwell on it.
Yeah, well, perhaps the department could offer some suggestions on that.
Okay, Jerry, you want to start?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Jared Bruce, and I'm representing the United Southeast Alaska Gill Netters. And we certainly share your concerns, Representative Davidson, about safety. We realize that the fishing industry doesn't have a great track record, and we need to do some things to improve that. And in fact, our association has had a fleet insurance program for our vessels for the last 4 years. And in that program, we've emphasized prevention of sinking through safety inspections, voluntary equipment, and training, as well as working with the underwriters to reward the fleet with the lower rates for these kinds of things. I think, we do support the spirit behind the legislation, but I would like to bring out some things that I would like to see worked on before the bill is passed out. One thing that gives us some problem are the life rafts. The vessels in our fleet range from about 25 feet in length up to about 50 feet in length. And primarily they are vessels fishing in outside waters. Although we do have quite a few of our members that participate in the halibut fishery, a few participate in the black cod fishery, a few crab and a few pot shrimp, and a few do various things, but the majority of them are salmon fishermen fishing in the inside waters. And the life raft not only is an expensive item, but it would be a difficult item to stow on the size vessels that we operate. And so I would like to recommend that the life raft only be considered for large vessels that are operating offshore, say beyond, you know, 3 miles or something like that, or even just something like that. Exposure suits, I think, are something that everyone should have on board, and we certainly emphasize that in our program. They've saved a number of lives in our fleet, and they are something that you can stow on a relatively small vessel, and it's certainly worth the cost, I think. The EPIRB, I'm not sure exactly whether that would be a recommended piece of equipment for the type of fleet that I'm representing. Most of the time we're fishing in a large group, and if anything happens, there's many people around to assist you. So the locator beacon really wouldn't have a function there. Now, there would be other circumstances where they might be traveling alone from one fishing district to another, or where they might be fishing in one of the longline fisheries and be away from a fleet, and a locator beacon might be very helpful and could save a life. But I'd like to think about that some and get back to some of the people in my organization and maybe comment back to you guys in writing in the subcommittee or how the bill progresses. One other thing that I think about the bill, as I said, you know, we have a large range and size of vessels in our fleet, and I don't really see the reason for the break in 32 feet. I mean, if a vessel is doing the same thing, a 30-foot vessel is doing exactly the same thing as a 40-foot vessel, it actually seems like maybe the 30-foot vessel is more at risk from heavy weather or something than the larger vessel. So I question whether that is really meaningful in a safety sense. Then I think that this is a difficult thing to do, I know, but if we could concentrate on preventing the sinkings through the education that you talked about and other kind of incentive programs, I think we'd get more bang for our buck that way, and it's certainly the kind of thing we're trying to emphasize in our program. There are people through the Sea Grant and other agencies that you can work with to try to put together safety programs, and you can also work with individual fishermen's associations like IRES who have a program, and to try to get these educational materials and raise the consciousness of people about safety. I really think that's all I have to say.
Mr. Bruce?
Yes.
Mr. Bruce, you talked about beyond 3 miles. Of course, we're talking about state law here, so if we want to go beyond 3 miles, this wouldn't be necessary anyway. But how active is your program of education? I mean, here's it's difficult to be in this position because, like I said before, I don't like forcing people to do things that are good for them. They should be they should have the incentive to do things that help save lives on their own. So, you know, as far as the education program is concerned, can you give us some idea of how often you have these classes, or how you make this emphasis, or how active is your program of safety education?
Well, we have an insurance committee that meets regularly and reviews the vessels and the operators in our program. We put out a regular newsletter in which we have safety notes and things like that. We're expanding our program to try to do more education and more. We're looking at going to a sort of self-inspection program on the vessels. We have been using marine surveyors, but there's a lot of difference in marine surveyors. Some marine surveyors are sale oriented. They're like real estate brokers. You know, they want to get the price of the boat up. Others are very safety conscious. So, and you don't really know, unless you have experience with an individual, which is which. So we're trying to go to a program where we inspect our vessels ourselves and can be certain that the safety equipment that we recommend beyond the vessels, which are bilge alarms, oil and water alarms, lazarette alarms, and exposure suits, are all there in good working condition. Certainly we could, we would like to make our program even more active, and we're trying to do the best we can, and if we could tie into a program through the state, that would aid us significantly.
If I may ask a couple more questions, Chairman. I think the key word here is emergency, and of course emergencies are very unpredictable, so I commend your fleet for the efforts that you're making, but do you have any figures on how many people have you lost in your fleet, say, over the last five years? Due to fishing accidents or tragedies?
There's one individual, off the top of my head, I can only think of one individual who lost his life in the last 5 years, and he lost his life in circumstances that would not have, the circumstances of his loss of life were that he was fishing in heavy weather, and his boat got closer to the beach than he realized, and the tide and everything was pushing on the beach very rapidly, and he was on the inside of his net, as a gill netter, he was trying to drum back off to pick up his net, and he couldn't do it in time. He tried to cut the net to get away from it, but it was he couldn't do it, and he crashed on the rocks, and the boat was destroyed, and he was drowned. As far as a loss of life from a vessel that sank and the people were in the water, I can't think of one in which, in a case where they were in the water and they didn't get picked up, where they died of exposure from being in the water too long or drowned. The other incident that I can think of where somebody lost their life was where it was a real, very, very sad situation. It was a whole family that lost their life, but they were, nobody knows exactly what happened, but it appears that the man fell overboard. His wife tried to help him get back in the boat. They found her body, and she had bruises all over her chest where she had been probably leaning over the gunwales. She must have gotten pulled into the water too, and then the baby probably just paddled, paddled over to the rail, and mom and dad were in the water and plopped in the water too, and so they all drowned. But those are the kinds of loss of life that we've had, rather than the kind of accident that you're trying to deal with.
Well, I know that, you know, every region and every fisheries is different. And so that's the difficulty of trying to make state law that applies to everyone. But still, you know, I'm most familiar with the fishing industry and in and around Kodiak, and I'm sure that that's not just the only place where there's a problem. And so, you know, as regards to your 30-foot comment, why 30 instead of 40, or we have to draw the line somewhere, and if you think it would be better at 30, I don't have a problem with that either, but, you know.
I guess my point is not so much the size of the boat is critical, but the kind of conditions the boat is operating in. And
how do you predict that, though?
Well, I would say you could look at vessels in inside waters compared to vessels, say, outside the surf line. And the surf line concept is something that's used in commercial fisheries management. That would be one way to do it. You could also look at it by fisheries. You know, certainly fisheries where people are operating in a large cluster like occurs in most of the salmon fisheries, you have a different kind of risk than when you're off by yourself, maybe crabbing or doing something like that. So I think that would be worth looking at to try to define the kind of fisheries and the kind of risks associated with those fisheries, and then design your program to address those.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions, Jerry? Thank you, Jerry. We'll keep you informed of the subcommittee progress.
Thank you.
When we're going to meet. Did you have something, Mr. Valentine?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Bill Valentine. I'm a Fish and Wildlife Protection Officer and a Lieutenant Detachment Commander. And I'm representing Public Safety. The department supports the concept of this bill merely because its intent is to save lives. There's a lot of questions on how, the mechanics, on how to do it. I think probably the best thing for me to do, we have written a position paper on a companion bill that was introduced in the Senate by Senator Zaroff. We haven't specifically addressed this House bill, so I think that maybe the best thing for me to do would be just have you ask me questions that you have. I think it may be easier, and we can just go down through the position paper however you like.
I think that one question that we've struggled with a little bit here today was whether or not to say that a certain size boat needs certain safety equipment as opposed to a certain activity that that boat's involved with. I'm wondering what your thoughts on that subject are.
Representative Cotton, I agree with the gentleman that testified just before me. A lot of it has to do with the application of the vessel and where it's operating. In our position paper, we put down 32 feet as a breakout point for no other reason than there has to be a line somewhere. 32 feet presently is the size of the boat that we don't allow one any larger than that to operate in Bristol Bay. Now that's the smallest boat that's where there's a regulation dealing with the size of the boat where it has to do with taking fish.
So in Bristol Bay you've got some boats 32 feet, no boats larger, some boats smaller though.
Representative Cotton, 32-foot boaters are the ones that are engaged in using nets. Of course, you have tenders, you have great big tramp steamers, and obviously you have smaller vessels than that.
But is the 32-foot limit in Bristol Bay is that's the upper limit, right?
That's the upper limit.
So you can use a smaller boat.
That's right. We suggested as well that the overall length be measured between the extremities of the boat. And here again, we're as much looking for direction from you as you are to us. That measurement wouldn't include rollers, gear for the deployment of anchors and nets, so forth. It would be just the overall length of the boat from stem to stern.
Well, if I could just, you know, try to get you to think about something other than a length standard. Now, the previous speaker suggested inside a surf line or another method of describing the activity, so that his point was perfect. I mean, if you're in Bristol Bay and you got one boat that's 32 feet and one that's 31 feet, they're both doing the same thing. One of them has to have safety equipment, the other one doesn't. Now, that doesn't make any sense.
Representative Cotton, that length only deals with having the life raft aboard. As the statute is, or as the bill is written, that all vessels engaged in commercial fishing would have at least survival suits. The break point is just for the raft.
But he suggested his intent was otherwise, even though the bill may say that my little jitney has to have survival suits for everybody aboard. That's, you know, a concern that I expressed. So it may well be that we want to take another look at that.
I agree with you, and as I stated before, that we may want to look at something that has to deal with the application of the vessel, maybe past the headlands, or as the previous gentleman testified, past the surf line, for the Class AE permit as well as the life raft.
Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said the department supports the concept of this bill. Can you expand on that?
That's real easy for me to expand on. I say concept, and concept is just a word. The Department of Public Safety is just that. It's a Department for Public Safety. Our number one mandated concern is search and rescue. For my division, it goes search and rescue, life and property, and the fishing laws, and the same with the Alaska State Trooper side. That's what I meant by that. Mm-hmm. We like the bill because, in essence, it wants to save lives, and we want to support that. The mechanics of how it's going to be done, we don't really know.
Does the department have any ideas as to how we can work on this bill to make it more acceptable to more people and in fact do the job of saving lives?
Right now we don't. I think that in subcommittee we could have myself or someone else. I think we could be a great deal of help to you, as well as provide you with some good input. I have a suggestion right now. It has to do with where the bill is presently put. Right now it's for Title 30. Mm-hmm. We would suggest that it would be included in Title 16. One of the reasons being that you're saying that vessels described in Title 16 as commercial fishermen or commercial fishing vessels, I think it would be a good place to have this law would be in Title 16. Part of it as well has to do with enforcement. The bill is written in such a way that enforcement is given to the Department of Public Safety and Fish and Game. Currently, Fish and Game, people employed by Fish and Game who are deputized to enforce the law are only deputized to enforce Title 16. They could not enforce Title 30.
Further questions?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if there's any other states or any states that I treat some of the inland water river systems as highways and do any kind of like public safety patrolling those areas?
I think Alaska is one of the last states that doesn't do what you mm-hmm. asked. We put that whole burden on the Coast Guard, and as you may know, the Coast Guard is now trying to put that burden back on us. The licensing inspection and so on and so forth.
Do you have any information on the other states as far as drawing their...
No, I don't. All I know is that the licensing inspection and so on and so forth is done by the individual states with the exception of Alaska.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to put this. Thank you. The bill into subcommittee. Representative Davidson, you'll be the chair. And there will be Cotton, Hoffman, myself, and Lavar. Anything further to come for the House Research Committee?
I would just like
tomorrow we'll be, is it okay? We'll be having a hearing on the guides and unlicensed guides bill. And if you could look at your packets and try to get a little bit updated, we should have a memo in there by the end of today on some what's going on. And Hoffman, we have Randall Burns and Anchorage online. Today we'll be talking about the, not necessarily the bill before us, but the issue of guides and outfitters. And I'd like to make some brief remarks on the issue. Of guides and unlicensed guides. I will most likely be referring to the unlicensed guides as outfitters, although I will also be talking about other aspects of this. What I don't mention today, I'd like my staff to go over We've had 3 days of public testimony in Anchorage on the issue. My staff has been meeting, as well as Representative Cotton's staff with guides and outfitters, both last session during the interim and this session. The outfitters have formed an association since the legislation has been introduced. These next 2 days of meetings will not necessarily focus on the piece of legislation, as I said, but it's more meetings to bring the issue before the committee, to update the committee on what's been taking place, and to familiarize the committee with the issue. The issue does have many sides to it, and one that's going to take a lot of work to resolve, you know, and hopefully as a committee we can come up with options. And I would like to mention how I see the issue. I think the issue directly affects me, and directly affects my district, and it affects much of rural and urban Alaska. You know, much sport hunting goes on in my district. We have lived with these conditions for years. You know, if you're going to fly to Bristol Bay in the fall time and you see the luggage being loaded on the plane, you'll see gun after gun after gun going onto these airplanes. And then you'll see, you know, the plane just full of hunters. And that's just the commercial part of it. You know, that there's other people just flying in there on their own. So you can see the impact. And then when these hunters return, that's all you'll see is a lot of the horns. And people in the district often will wonder, well, where's the meat at? And that's kind of like the historical perspective. And then there has been a lot of abuse of hunting privileges in this state. The wanton waste laws and penalties have helped cut down on some of that abuse. And I believe that, you know, Senator Sackett worked very hard on some of those laws. We do have a guide law in the state, and there's been much abuse of that law. There have also been changes to that law. And there are guides that abide by that law and guides that don't, just as there will be good outfitters as well as bad. And then I'm wondering, you know, if any of you committee members have ever seen a map of guide areas. And I saw one of my district, and it just chops the area up so much, you just wonder, you know, how the resource will fare with all those guide areas. And then you have these outfitters, you know, that are acting as guides and that can go all over the state because they are not restricted to an area. And then what incentive do these guides, or these outfitters have to be concerned about the resource? You know, not much if they can just deplete an area and move on to another area. And you'll hear stories of how much pressure these outfitters that are acting as guides have on the resource, and the people in my district can verify this. You know, my people count on these resources to live, and, you know, what good is having a subsistence hunt if there's no resource? So there's many points to be made, and the committee will start to see all the different sides, you know, of the issue through testimony. You'll see there are some people, what some people call legitimate guides, who do just that, outfit hunts, trips, etc., but do not do any hunting. And there are other categories here too, and so we have to decide how to get rid of the unlicensed guides, many being from outside the state. There's many questions on the issue, and with that, I'd like my staff to further talk about some of the issues of surrounding the guides and outfitters, and also to tell us some of what's in the packet, because there is a lot of good information in this packet, and if she can just briefly tell us what's in there, then I would hope that a lot of you could look at that.
Nice wording, right? It's pretty impressive.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Deborah Greenberg, and I'm a staff representative Herman in the House Resources Committee. And briefly, both packets, Volume 1 and Volume 2, have at the head of them an outline or a table of contents with the sections, and these packets were originally put together for the interim hearings, and they've been updated with all the letters we've received in Representative Herman's office to date. in support, in opposition, and other letters that were just supplying information, and it's sort of a usual outline. We did not include all the Senate bills at this time, but went with the original bill and then the bill they passed out, because there have been probably over 16 versions or so at this point. And the guide law is in there, and then both of the LBNA legislative budget and audit reports and the responses to those reports from the guide board, and position papers from the various agencies involved, AG's opinions on the issues of residency, and then selected articles. And those are full table contents in both packets. We've also added a new section that is advertisements from various outfitters. Madam Chairman, one of the things that I think I am supposed to address today is just to give a better outline of how complex this issue was as we discovered it during the interim hearings. And the way I figured that out was I came with these packets to the interim hearings, and they were labeled guides and outfitters, and the first thing Representative Herman said to me was, somehow that titling just isn't right. And as we looked at that issue through the interim, it became clear that guides and outfitters, to term it that way, was not really truly reflective of how complex the issue is and how diverse the groups are and the people are and the circumstances in which they engage in the commercial operations where they benefit economically from the game resource. And it became apparent that there was a broad spectrum, and the reason that may be valuable to the committee is that the Senate, when they went through crafting language in any number of versions in any number of ways, began to discover that every time you tried to do one thing, you discovered that there's a new little group or a little constituency with a special concern that would be affected one way. And I was going to try to just outline what some of those have been, and without speaking to how the language could or would affect those. As I said, I think the main thing is that there's a really broad spectrum of commercial users of the resource that benefit in a number of different ways. The first and most obvious one is the licensed guides, master guides with areas, guides that have their areas, they operate with areas. And within that group, there are a number of different constituencies and concerns that seem to have been voiced. And without trying to speak for the guides, I just want to note some of the things that have come up from different of those groups. Some of them have been more concerned than others. Some have voiced concern about the operations of the guide board. Some of them have felt very strongly that the guide board operates well. A number of them, in getting to the place where they are with areas, had expressed different problems or different concerns, and others felt the system was successful. Then there are a number of licensed guides, who are guides that have gone through the system and are licensed but have no area to operate in. So in order to really operate, they need to be working with a guiding area. It's a very different kind of situation since they have no area. The licensed guide is further broken down in that there are a number of licensed guides who have voiced their concern that they want to stick by the guide system and that they want to really try to work their way up through that guide system as it's currently expressed. Some of them expressing that there are difficulties and their problems are as there are with any system, and others that are expressing that the system is just fine with them. Then there are those licensed guides who have expressed discontent with the system and are now feel that they belong in a class with outfitters, that that's what they're doing because of their frustration. So that is one more group of individuals that are looking at the situation from a different point of view, and when you start crafting legislation, you find that these people's concerns come out as well. Then it sort of breaks into aside from the problems people have or have not experienced with the guide system,
It's also clear that within this professional group, as within any professional group, there are those that manage to play by the rules, and there are those that don't. And that is equally true of what we are calling outfitters or unlicensed guides. When this concern first came to the table, it came to the table because it was clear, as you can see from your packets in section 11, where there are a bunch of advertisements, that there are a number of outfitters or unlicensed guides. I guess that's the term we're using. It sounds kind of bureaucratic, but who are from outside, who advertise hunts, some of whom try to guarantee hunts here, who are not found on any of the registers, who are not found to be licensed. And that is brought a great deal of concern about this issue, and been one of the reasons that this issue has grown. And a number of those people, I'm sure there have been some people in that category who have also been in trouble with the law in taking more game, hidden game illegally in numbers and operating throughout the state. And many of those are just in outright, they're just outright violating the law. I mean, those people that are actually advertising for hunts and are actually hunting in the field. Then there's another group of, when you start developing language and legislation, trying to craft legislation that attempts to deal with this issue, that becomes apparent, and that is, there are various groups, there's a whole spectrum of service providers who may need to be in the field to provide their service. And that becomes a complicated thing, because there are those people that feel they belong in the field to provide that service, and then there are those people that feel that because these people can be in the field to provide that service, it is just something that gives them an excuse to hunt. It's clear that there are probably some people there that are using that as an excuse to hunt. That's one group. And then it is also clear that there are a number of people there that may have legitimate businesses and really not at all be engaged in hunting. And in that group, too, there is also a number of people who clearly have targeted their clientele only at hunters, and there are also people who clearly, whose clienteles are much more diverse than that. Their clienteles aren't just hunters or fishermen, they're people who are looking for some kind of wilderness experience without doing any kind of hunting or fishing. There's video photographers, there's a number of other things. And then there's a whole class of service providers, sometimes also referred to as legitimate outfitters, that include things like packers, people that provide, I want to say bed and breakfast all of a sudden, I don't know why, but I'm trying to say provide food in the field and set up base camps and whatever. And that has created a lot of debate whether those people should or should not be in the field, and there's obviously mixed concern there. Meat packers is another category. The other category is a group of people who provide services in the field and whose clientele can in part be hunters, but whose approach apparently is not one that is exactly consistent with what the guide's approach is in the field. Some of them are less interested in just targeting hunts or having their clients target hunts while they are out there, as they are in a complete wilderness experience, I guess is how it would be termed. And then there are another number of people in the field for other reasons, such as providing first aid. Transportation is another big issue. Air taxi operators, people who drop off clients in the field, don't necessarily provide any services. There are also air taxi operators who do provide services. That's a very important issue to a lot of people. For some air taxi operators, dropping off hunters into the field somewhere is a big part of their business. And for others, the concern is that air taxi operators also drop their clients and sometimes
are dropping so many clients in one place that people are concerned about what the role is of air taxi operators. Another category that came up and is has a special provision for it in the current guide law deals with boat operators with living quarters, and that was targeted at certain areas in the state where people who engage in fishing operations and during the winter or the off season, as it would be, use their boats and their gear to get people out to some kind of hunting area. That is another group, and that has been a concern in Southeast and Kodiak as well. There are other kinds of transporters, including small boats, rafts, people that take people out in the field, people that say they need to be in the field with the people, with their hunters or other clientele, people that are providing, say, horses to get people in the field. That's another group there, small group that comes into play. And the other thing is that some language that was crafted, some proposals got so far that not only included in them or affected by the language were people who were in the field, but people who were out of the field as well. Certain language has been crafted in the past that would have affected people who rented equipment to hunters who then went to the field. And that may or may not have been the intent when those things were drafted, but nevertheless it came into play, and it's another group of commercial operators to be aware of and think about how legislation affects them as it's crafted. The general public is another group that is affected and has been affected or would be affected by some of the language that has been proposed in numerous of the CSs, and that's the general public who goes out and hunts for themselves, does not make money off hunting, maybe takes friends out from outside or from here on a hunt, and that has been another major area of concern. The other group, of course, are subsistence users, people who are dependent on the resource for their sustenance, and they are also affected by this one way or another, depending on how the whole issue affects the resource. And I think, Madam Chairman, that is pretty much the variety. I don't hope I haven't left anything out. It hasn't been deliberate omissions, but it then became very apparent that there's a very broad spectrum of user groups, and that each proposal of language that has to date been put forward has affected one of those user groups one way or the other and addressed certain problems or created certain problems for those user groups. And because of the complexity of the user groups and the differences in how those user groups are using the resource and the differences in their approach to abiding by the laws and the regulations, it's made a big difference in the impact on the resource. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Chalky. Are there questions? Thank you very much. Randall, are you online in Anchorage then?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Okay, could you go ahead and just give us your testimony and, you know, fill us in on a little bit of, you know, what your job is and things like that, okay?
Excuse me. For the record, my name is Randall Burns. I'm Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing. We have the pleasure of having administrative oversight of the Guide Board under the Division of Occupational Licensing. And for that reason, I'm here today. I'm fairly new to the division since September of last year, so the issues affecting the Guide Board are new to me, obviously not nearly as new now as they were 2 months ago. I want today to give you a fairly general overview of the operations of the Guide Board so that I can hopefully give you some context in which to view all the controversy. For some reason, it was, and I appreciate Chalky's description of the users, because it puts, again, what I'm also attempting to do is put into context how the Guide Board sort of falls into this, and the Guide Board tends to be the focus of all of these issues, but it really is but one segment of it, and I think that's an important thing to remember. I also think it's important to remember that that we need to distinguish between the issues that directly affect the guide board as an administrative agency, for which there's a great deal of anger and frustration and controversy. But still, those are separate from those issues which typically relate to the public policy issue surrounding the regulation of the commercial taking of game. And I want to see if we can draw that distinction, because it's important that we look at the guide board as a regulatory agency and an administrative agency. And although obviously it's directly affected in the issue and direct of the commercial taking, its importance is somewhat less, and it becomes just one of the other players. The operations of the guide board itself, I think, are far more manageable problems, in my opinion, than the more difficult issue of how whether to regulate the commercial taking of game in a manner different from what obviously rather imperfectly exists today. So I see my job as trying to put the performance of the guide board into perspective. From the outset, I think we should know that there are obviously considerable problems with the guide board, and that's probably not a surprise to you. We've all heard horror stories, albeit many of them are entertaining horror stories about the guide board. They're usually very Alaskan and definitely unbureaucratic in their nature, but unfortunately, they're unbureaucratic in the worst sense of the word, which is oftentimes the stories are reflecting what happens is at the expense of due process and the usual administrative procedures that we rely on to bring consistency and fairness to administrative decision making. And since I started here, I have received obviously hundreds of calls about from anyone from a licensed guide to unhappy attorneys to unhappy legislators to unhappy outfitters. And in many cases, the complaints I have looked into are determined to be valid. So I'd like to be real specific and go over with you some of the major areas of problem. And maybe as I do this, try to see if we can show you how that relates to the general problem that you hear about the guide board. First one is the map. And Madam Chairman, I asked you, were they able to bring one of those maps to the room?
Yeah, I've got a couple right here.
Yes, we do have two here, Randall.
Okay. The big map, the one that yes, hopefully you can see or it's hanging somewhere, those are...
Hey, Randall?
Yeah?
We haven't got them hanging yet.
Oh, okay. Could we hold it up just briefly at least, maybe?
Yeah, she's doing that now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While she's doing that, let me explain that what this is, that they're unfurling, as it were, is a game unit map. And where there are 22 of these maps in various sizes, depending on the size of the game unit, but there are 22 of them. As you can see, they're very old. Most of these were made in the early 70s. And for each game unit in the state, 22 game units, they created a map on which they were then going to draw the guide particular areas. And all the lines all over that map, and I apologize for not being there to show you specifically what I'm talking about, but probably you can see that it's real difficult to sort of figure out whose lines go where and who actually has access to what areas. And to even make it worse, you must understand that those maps are the only existing information as to who does and does not have a guide area. Between that and the individual file map, that's all we have. There is no other piece of paper anywhere else to assist us in this project. To make it worse, the lines that are drawn on those maps have not been kept up. So if there have been changes to any of those units, which there have been, if they've been transferred, if they've been removed and given to somebody else, sometimes they were updated and sometimes they were not. So they're actually, we can't even rely specifically on those maps because they've not been updated. And as you can see, at this point, it's real difficult to make sense of the lines that are on there. In addition, believe it or not, some of those lines are fairly thin, and it isn't a problem. Some of the lines are wider, and because of the size of the state of Alaska, a wide line on that map may go down, let's say, the middle of a drainage, and because of the width of the line going down the drainage in a particular area, we have disputes over about whether or not a guide has access to one side or the other of the drainage where that line is. Now that may sound petty, but you must understand that a good drainage area could have access to a lot of bear or other kinds of game that are important to the guide. And so even the width of the lines and the accuracy of those lines is the basis of a number of controversies between the guides and the guide board itself. The individual guide maps then are supposedly supposed to be, maybe they could show you, somebody there could show you, hold up one of the individual guide maps.
Okay.
Whenever a guide applies for an area, they're supposed to produce a map showing on that individual map what area they're looking to have access to. And then if that guide area is approved for that individual, then that map that they gave, presented to the board when they applied for the transfer or for the original application, is then put in the guide's file, and that is supposedly the one true map for that guide. Unfortunately, in many of these guide's files, there are five or six maps, because they sometimes apply and they get turned down. Some of the maps in their files have lines drawn out and squiggled over, and because during the board meeting, the area was changed. Sometimes this is noted and it's written on by the board, and sometimes it's not. And so again, even the individual guide maps are not accurate. So what we have here is, unfortunately, we've given guides access both to exclusive areas and joint use of areas, but neither the large display maps nor their individual maps are an accurate representation of what areas they may have been granted permission to. And so it's really a difficult problem, because if we can't tell a guide what areas they actually have, or they know what areas they have, and they're more than happy to tell you what they believe to be the actual boundaries. But if someone who does not have an area wants to come in to the guide board and look at those maps and see if there's an area available for them to apply, they can go up to that large map and they can say, oh, well, sure, here's an area that's available. And then they can't just rely on that, though. They have to actually research every single other guide, go to their individual files, pull out their individual map, and make sure there hasn't been some change in those areas before they can apply. And invariably, of course, since those maps have not been updated, the area has either been claimed, somebody else had access to it, and it's rare for them to be able to find an area without much work that's available to them. And that just isn't any way to run this system. So that, if ever you hear anything about the frustration of guides who, as Shockey described, are licensed guides that don't have areas and are unhappy with the system, it's because just on its face, looking at the map, it looks like they're never going to have access to the system because they can't figure out, and it's difficult for the staff of the Division of Occupational Licensing to assist them in determining what areas may even be available to apply for. And if it doesn't look like there's any areas to apply for, it looks like the state is tied up and there's no access and so they're never going to get in. So that's one of the issues, one of the major issues and frustrations that people have about the guide.